This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanisan and Wang Xiaoning beaming over to us from an undisclosed location in the heart of the Klang Valley. It is 8:36 in the morning, Thursday the 19th of November, and in about 10 minutes we're diving into UMNO reforms led by the youth of the party with analysis from Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. But before that, we're talking about the latest in COVID-19 vaccines.
Yes, yesterday Pfizer became the first company to deliver complete results from its late-stage trials, revealing that its vaccine was 95% effective without serious side effects. It also says its vaccine was found to offer protection to people of all ages and ethnicities. Earlier this week, we had additional news here that Moderna announced its vaccine had an effectiveness rate of over 94%, but we are still waiting to know more about how long these shots will protect people for. For example, will they need regular booster shots for example?
So for more on what we can expect moving forward, we're speaking this morning with Sam Fazeli, a senior healthcare analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence. Sam, thank you so much for joining us. Now, markets rallied on the back of vaccine news, but is this really cause for excitement in your view?
Yes, absolutely. So the reason I'm excited is that just about everybody that I know, including myself, was hoping we would get a vaccine that would give us protection at the 60-70%. 80% level. We were all geared up, ready to accept that because that would already be quite a useful vaccine to control the disease if sufficient people were vaccinated. So to see the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and the Moderna vaccine give us 90% plus efficacy in their first read is really gratifying. And I don't think there's a scientist out there who didn't shed a tear when they saw this outcome. What we also know from Moderna is that there were no severe cases of COVID in the vaccine group, whereas there were 11 in the placebo group. We know the vaccine works in the elderly, at least their vaccine works in the elderly. So even though this is early data, it is certainly a great place to be starting the process of taking a vaccine to people and protecting our communities.
So how do these two vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, stack up against one another, whether it's because of ease of distribution or their effectiveness? Is one going to be much more successful than the other?
So I don't think we can say that at all at the moment. Some people have tried to take more out of the data than you can by looking at the 94.5% efficacy level that risk reduction level that Moderna reported versus the more than 90% that Pfizer reported. But to me, at this stage of the data, with this number of cases, all that we can say is that these two vaccines are probably as effective as each other in preventing disease until we see more details about the subgroups and how the two vaccines behave in subgroups of people, the older people, the people with so-called comorbidities who are more susceptible to the disease, people of different ethnic origins. All of that has yet to come. Today, my view is that these two vaccines so far look similar.
And what do we know about how much of these vaccines have been bought by governments like the US? Do companies have the production capacity to fulfill those purchases?
Well, yes, over time. So, you know, we know that both companies have several billions of doses that have been ordered together. And both are going to be able to make tens of millions of doses per month during 2021. You should assume around 30 to 40 million or up to 50 million full vaccine courses are going to be available per month during 2021 when you add the two companies up. And we have contracts everywhere and all over the place. Every country, even new ones, are constantly being added. Of course, with this data, other countries that had not signed up to Pfizer or Moderna are now beginning to think about having to do it. An example was the UK government, who moved really quickly to get a certain million doses. So there's lots of deals around already. Some countries have many more doses that they have contracted for than they need. For example, Canada tops that list at about 9 doses of vaccine per inhabitant. But of course, remember that they're not going to use all of this. These are basically, they're both insurance policies. To be in a position to not knowing which vaccine was going to work, to have access to these different vaccines. And I think all those contracts have in them clauses that says if your vaccine doesn't work, well, obviously there's nothing to buy here. And then, of course, if all the vaccines work and the countries have got access to all the vaccines, I'm convinced they will be donating doses to Gavi for potentially using in areas who have not been able to gain access to vaccines.
Are there other production bottlenecks? For example, is there sufficient global supply for things like glass vials or syringes?
Well, again, remember, we still have to fill and finish the many millions and billions of doses of cancer drugs that need to be produced in glass vials and the needles that are required to inject them into people. So this becomes an additional requirement. But frankly, what this does is just mean that we may have to temper our expectations as to how quickly we can get our populations vaccinated. It's not going to be a complete roadblock. It's going to be something that can get resolved. You know, I keep telling people we just put X number of astronauts into the air and into space and managed to get them to dock onto the International Space Station. I'm sure we can solve the requirement for glass vials and rubber stoppers and needles. It just will take time.
Now, we're still expecting to hear news from AstraZeneca, the other closely watched frontrunner. What are you expecting to see from them?
Yes, so they're using not an mRNA vaccine, which is what Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna have used. They're using a new technology or a different new technology, which uses another virus to deliver the piece of the coronavirus that is required to induce an immune system. Here we have seen in early trials that perhaps the immunogenicity, the amount of immune response that they got in the early human trials was not as high as those seen for Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech. So there is a risk that when they report their efficacy data, it's not as good. But we don't know what level of immune response is required to get us to this 90% level. It may be that what Astra has is enough already. And then you have the other issue in that their trial in the UK and their trial in Brazil is relatively complicated in terms of the way it was designed. So it may not have the same statistical power as the 30,000, 44,000 trials that were done in the US by the companies Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech. So those are a couple of risks that I'm going to watch for. I wish them the best of luck in getting exactly the same efficacy and even better, but we just don't know.
Meanwhile, Sam, do we have any information on the Russian and Chinese vaccine candidates?
Well, we've seen early data published for both, and a Chinese vaccine, CoronaVac, just had a paper published in The Lancet, but these are still all the type of studies that show you an immune response. They don't show you how protective the vaccines are. So we just need to see some of that data published or presented somehow so that we can analyze it and compare it. And, you know, in the early trials that they did, the immune responses were good. Again, not knowing what level of immune response is a threshold that you require, it's difficult to know how that would work in the actual prevention of disease. We don't have data for that. We hear things in press releases and government officials from different countries speaking about it, but we haven't seen the data. Until we see the data, we can't judge for ourselves.
Thank you so much for speaking with us this morning, Sam. That was Sam Fazeli of Bloomberg Intelligence, helping us make some sense of all of the vaccine news that we've heard over the course of the last few weeks. Now, Shanning, what were some of your takeaways from the conversation with Sam?
That scientists are shedding a little tear all around the world on the back of the news of the vaccine. And so am I, because I want my old life back. I think all of us do. But I don't want to pour cold water on this news. It's going to be some time before all of us get vaccinated, where there's some level of herd immunity and life can return to somewhat normal. In the meantime, we still need to practice all those SOPs. So wash your hands, keep the physical distancing. Don't pergi ke sana, ke sini, unless you really need to.
Yeah, and you know, Sam, at the end towards that, we were talking about the China vaccine, and earlier on, we were talking about how some countries like Canada have 9 doses per inhabitant based on the deals and the contracts that are in place, because they're hedging their bets, right? Some deals, not all are going to become effective, so at least you have more in place, and if more become effective, then maybe they donate it. On that note, Malaysia and China have signed a deal, or at least come to an agreement, that gives Malaysia priority access to COVID-19 vaccines developed by China, knowledge and expertise sharing, as well as facilities, scientific and technological capabilities to advance vaccine development in both countries. Basically, we're working with China to develop and share knowledge here. And this agreement will be enforced for 5 years. So this was something between the China's science ministry as well as our own MOSTI, and which is the Ministry of Science, Technology and Innovation, as well as the Foreign Affairs Ministry of Malaysia.
Yeah, so this was something that was promised back in October, and it appears to have come to fruition as much as it can without an actual vaccine candidate to be dealing with. And there is also the option for this agreement to be extended, I believe, a year at a time after the initial 5-year contract period. So we'll be watching that story as well very closely. But right now we're about to head into some messages. And then up next, we're diving into UMNO reforms with analysis from Dr. Bridget Welch, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.